So very nice to greet all of you again. We meet in love, I trust, not in hopes and expectations. Because if we meet with hopes and expectations, we meet with preconceptions, which are almost always disappointed in some respect or other. And if they are satisfied, then our meeting hasn't brought about real growth, because that which would have been growth has already been preconceived in some form by you. So what have you gained? So I hope I trust we meet in love, which means meet with a completely open mind and an open heart, not looking forward to anything, not desiring anything. This is very important. We meet because we cannot help meeting. We are here. That is all. And if we are here in terms of real attentiveness, then there is no barrier between any one of us present here and everyone else present here. I must say something as a preliminary to this week's meetings. It is not unlikely that I may not be present again. Another year, another years. There is always, as the Buddha taught so wonderfully, this great cycle in the becoming process of coming into being, decaying, and going out of manifested being, the manifested pattern that you are acquainted with. And if we grasp that in our memory, then we bind ourselves. Amongst the last words of the Buddha, have I not told you again and again that it is the nature of all things which have come into being to pass away? If we bear this in mind, if we are capable of bearing it in mind, then there is real mindfulness, real attentiveness. This is the whole thing now, in the immediate present. And if we live totally in the immediate present, then there has been living in eternity, in the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. And what is not put together can never be broken asunder. There is a great art in meeting, and this is something like what I mean by saying we meet in love. Because this word love stands fundamentally for that which is indescribable, which is inconceivable. It cannot be grasped. If we don't attempt to grasp it, it takes us into itself. So, let us try and be attentive. I will try and attend to all of you. That means be as sensitive as I possibly can to all of you. And it might prove to be your own happiness, your own well-being, not ill-being, the ill state, if you could also respond in that way. Not merely reciprocate, because reciprocation is a conditional thing, a thing of payment. But that which is given totally, freely, just given, and that which is totally and freely received can then evoke out of you the response which has no conditions to it, no sorrow attached to it, no mere pleasure attached to it. It is not merely a state of mind. It is a mode of awareness. And the whole story of our spiritual development, our fulfillment, whether we regard it individually or quite impersonally, of fulfillment is just that. Do not approach religion and the religious life . Let it approach you. In fact, it approaches us all the time. It is around us, within us, in us, completely holds us in. When I make the approach, I throw up barriers against it. I am unhappy. I am dissatisfied. Frustrated, frightened, confused. I want to find myself. I want to attain nirvana. I want to tread the path. You see what I'm doing? Self-oriented. And the moment one is self-oriented, one has become the irremovable obstruction to the beauty, the reality, the marvel, the truth of life itself. Do we come to the summer school to gain something, to find something? Or do you like to reverse the situation and say, oh no, I come in order to give something, only to serve the others? Illusions, obstructions all along the line. Life lives us. Let life live us. Then the Buddha's words, at the heart of all things lies celestial bliss, is true. It is unobstructed, this celestial bliss. I have to use a word bliss. For myself, if I were to use the word, a word which in the dictionary means the very opposite of bliss, it would mean precisely the same thing. In fact, you know why? Because in the realm of fact, that which is, all words are misnomers. There is no discrimination, no picking and choosing in the realm of totality, in the realm of the wholeness. There is picking and choosing and discrimination in the particular limited context. There, of course. And that is why there is what we call perfect or right effort required. Because we are in a limited context. Not in terms of the absolute fact, but in terms of my own state of ignorance. Because I'm unawake. Not fully in relationship, not totally aware of the totality around me. Therefore, I'm in a limited context. I am the limitation. And if I really know that, not as a string of words, but in my inner sensitivity, I'm fully awake to that, that is the fact. About me, the limited particular, then my limited particularity becomes the focus point of the unlimited totality. My so-called flaws are transformed into divine virtues. So, do not approach religion with any particular aim. If we want to think in terms of an aim, and we say that the aim is nirvana, or liberation, or moksha, or heaven, or whatever you like to call it, if we like to approach the situation as an aim, does not the aim really stand for transcendence itself, for the absolute all? Well then, how can I make it an aim? Where shall I go to find it? This is reality, totality, here now. How can I grasp anything at all? Can I grasp any bit of space? You try grasping a bit of space and saying, ah, I've got a bit of space with me. How much will you give me for it? Can it be done? No. Nirvana is like that. The other shore is like that. Ungraspable, unseizable. You can look back into the words of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad when Yajnavalkya says about the Atma. It is not this, it is not this, it is not this. It is not long, not short, not coarse, not fine, not anything. It is the absolute all, unborn, birthless, ageless, decayless, sorrowless, deathless. Therefore, how can it be an aim? We go seeking that which cannot be sought. It is here. Let it be. I must cease to obstruct it. This is the important task, to cease to obstruct it, because this is what I, with my limited vijnana, my discriminative consciousness, which is always self-oriented, if you look very carefully into it, you will find that every effort, everything is self-oriented in some form or other. The very philosophy that there is no self comes out of a self-oriented mind. I mean the words. They come out of a self-oriented mind. And this is what spoils the reality. What did the Buddha say about himself, for instance, when he talked about not I, Siddhartha, the son of my father and mother, but the Tathagata. The Tathagata is trackless, untraceable. Where will you find him? Where will you look for him? Do I become a Tathagata then? Because there is the I, becoming. Nearer and nearer, oh yes, another step, but this Everest ever climbs 10 steps higher with every step up I take. We must understand these things in depth. See, these are all the signs of dukkha, aren't they? This is the ill state, my ill state. That I don't look into fundamentals. I think of fundamentals and treat them as if they were so many logical propositions, verifiable by experiment, provable by some clever logical system. You look through the Brahmajala Sutta, for instance, very carefully, and see the extraordinary significance of the Buddha's words, not to be understood by mere logic, words which he uses. The Tathagata knows that there are other things, sweet, tranquilizing, and so on, beautiful words which he uses. You see, not to be understood by mere logic, but to be realized by the wise. And one can never become wise. One can become clever. One can acquire knowledge in our dictionary meaning of the word. But we can never acquire, grasp wisdom. You can be wise. Wisdom is not acquired. It is a constituent of being. It is constitutive of being. Just as happiness is constitutive of being. It's really important to understand this. Consider, for instance, the fact that we must all acknowledge this. It's the stimulus of sorrow, frustration, confusion in the mind and so forth, which drives us, say, we'll just confine ourselves to Buddhism, the same is true of religion. All these things drive us to take to Buddhism as something which will bring us the desired result. We are already preconceiving a state. And we take to Buddhism in order to get away from that which is actually present in our own consciousness, in our own mind, in our own everyday life. And the struggle and the conflict and the misery of everyday life drives us this way. But the very act of getting away is an act which perpetuates conflict. You can turn around and fight against the actual situation and say, no, I will overcome, which is also a conflict. And both are states of misery. Just let us stay exactly where we are. Exactly where we are. And see the situation in its wholeness. Use our senses. This is what so few people in the world ever do. Rightly use their senses. Unfortunately, several religious philosophies decry the senses. Beware the senses. They say, the Buddha taught that. No, he didn't. He said, beware of the pleasures of the senses. But he very definitely taught, use the senses rightly. When you look, look, and see what you are seeing. Be aware of it actually and not imaginarily. Seeing what you want to see. Or seeing with eyes that don't see straight. See the fact as the fact. And become aware of all the conditioning of the mind which makes one not see the fact as the fact. All our desires, all our unresolved discords are the influences which prevent us from seeing, from hearing, from touching, from tasting, and so on. All this, which is truth itself, there is no other truth. This is the reality, the whole reality here and now. But don't let us say that, I see the whole thing as it is, this is the whole truth. No. If it is true that I am seeing the whole thing as it is, let us grant that I've trained my sense of sight so well, I'm a trained scientist or whatever you like, and therefore I see, yes, this is the case. But then I mustn't say that this is the whole of it. I don't know the whole of it. I only know to the limits of human ability, no more. When a dog sees you and wags his tail, he sees to the limits of his canine ability. When I see you and say, oh, hello, and shake hands and how are you and so forth, I see you, let us assume, to the limits of my ability. The dog, I'm afraid, doesn't know you're a musician, you're a philosopher, you're somebody's wife or husband or brother or sister, but he wags his tail quite merrily. And I say hello and I'm perfectly affable and amiable, I trust, quite merrily, you see. But I mustn't delude myself that, I've seen the whole thing, I haven't. Only to the limits of my ability. But if I do this, which is my task, fulfill my duty this way, then something grows inside, by itself. It just grows. Oh, what is this growth? It is not a limited something which grows, but it is an obstructiveness here, which is in here, which is the me, an obstructiveness which has ceased to be obstructive, or is ceasing to be obstructive. Mindfulness is an extraordinary thing. It's a magical thing. It's a thing of power and beauty which enables the obviously separate individual as he is in the world of living men and women to be the whole, although in apparent manifestation he is the part. This is something which happens in the deeps of consciousness, in the deeps of awareness. Consciousness is not a very good word, because the word consciousness always implies at least one fundamental separation: the subject who is conscious of the object. This is the difficulty with that word consciousness. So there is always this separation. But when that self-sense, I the subject, being conscious of whatever it is, and it's a terrible delusion, oh, I was conscious of nirvana for 5.5 seconds, or was it 5.42986 seconds, you see. That's a terrible delusion. That was not nirvana, my friend. This is the difficulty with the word consciousness. But when that self-sense has really become completely empty of selfness, completely empty, this is one of the real meanings, I think, of the word void, the shunya. The self-sense has become empty of selfness, and then there is only the totality. I forget who said it. First there was just God and me. Now there is only God. That's it. That is the end of dukkha, the finishing of all dukkha. Not just my pain and misery. A Buddha has pains too. He has a stomachache or a headache and in fact, you read your Majjhima, it's in the Majjhima. He says to Mahanama, please correct me if I'm wrong, he says to Mahanama, well, what was all your talk about? My back was aching standing outside listening to you people inside. Well, the enlightened Holy One had a backache. Why can't you and I, therefore, not be in dreadful misery that we get backaches? Or even swollen toes. So come back to this business about conflict. We go away from that which is troubling us, thinking, we'll find what? My desire. But my desire is the extraordinarily prolific generator of all my dukkha. Tanha, Trishna, the thirst for sentient existence, the second noble truth. Why this thirst for sentient existence? It's natural, that's all. We, being what we are, not having come to fruition yet, suffer from this thirst for sentient existence. But don't let me fight against the thirst for sentient existence. Because my fight against my desire to overcome desire will originate in another desire, which is again self-oriented. So you see, there's no escape from it that way. It is really very important to understand this, really understand it. Let me say a word or two about understanding. We come to know in the ordinary, everyday manner in terms of a logically structured system of thought. Now, how does our logical faculty come into being? When we are born, we just see things, hear things. We don't know them as the adult knows them. These are all percepts for the very first time. You see your mother. You taste the milk which you suckle, and so on. Percepts. A whole lot of percepts. And these percepts begin to get coordinated by words which those around us use. And slowly, in the brain of this infant growing up, there are formed concepts, pictures, are held in the mind. Ah, that's mother. Now there is a recognition. It's a concept coming into play. As we grow up, our whole our training teaches us to be logical, as we call it. So we say, oh, this and that being there, therefore this and that is here. Or we deduce it purely intellectually when we start learning geometry and all the rest of it. These are the premises, and here are the logical steps for the proof. But what are we doing? The mind has been conditioned to call that logic. It may be logic. I would go further and say, yes, at least in part it is logic. Because if it were totally divested of logic, then nothing would cohere, nothing would come into being at all. No manifestation process could possibly take place there. So there is a certain degree of logic, but it's a conditioned logic. You and I in England, Europe, with a European Christian cultural background, civilization, history, and so forth, we have all this built into our mental life. So that our mind has become a machine merely, or very largely. Occasionally, when this mind is free of this prison of our mental conditioning, then in that state of ease in the mind, light suddenly shoots out. A ray of understanding, perhaps. And you say, oh, I've got it, that's it. Then, of course, we fall back, because of our conditioning and what we are, into the state where we say, oh, I've got it. The job's done. It isn't. Don't hold on to it. Don't grasp it. Attend to it completely, fully, and it will effect a transformation in your psychophysical being, your psychophysical makeup, and leave you more and more open for eternal light to shine through. Light perpetual will shine through you. This is the thing. This is wisdom, if you like. And In that process, this psychophysical organism grows in that sensitivity which is real understanding. It has a dual aspect, at least a dual aspect to it. One is this warm feeling aspect. The other is the cool, observing intellectual aspect, purely intellectual aspect. That is cool. But it's the one mind at work, remember. When this can happen, then there is understanding. Now you see why. Because you and your experience have met in reality. You have entered into your experience. You have rejected nothing, refused nothing. You have accepted nothing in the sense of grasping at it. This is good. Oh, I like it. This is fine. The moment there is something good and you like it, beware. It's a white hot iron. Don't catch hold of it. It's very pleasant to look at in the distance, but keep it at a distance. So understanding grows that way. And you will find that as understanding grows, this acquisition of concepts, which we are so keen upon, this system of philosophy, Buddhist or Hindu, Mahayana or Hinayana or anything like that, this grasping of the concepts and thinking we are learning, we are getting on, that grasping will cease. Now read your texts. Go look at the concepts. Now you can meet the concepts. And what will happen? When you meet the concepts, the living truth which this dead brown paper of concepts wraps up, you see, will be free. It will be yours. Instead of the mere external packing. Hard task, you know. And yet, it is as easy as breathing. Why is my breathing easy? Because there's nothing in the body or of the body which obstructs the breathing process. It just goes on naturally. I don't interfere with it. One lives by letting live. Not a case of live and let live in that sort of condescending, rather supercilious attitude. So now, let's look again at this thing, this thirst for sentient existence. Do we understand the meaning of this thirst for sentient existence? It is the expression at the organic level of something transcendent which is awaiting emergence through you, the living psychophysical organism. This body had a primordial ancestor, a primate. Let us assume that what some scientists have said on the matter is more or less true. Because scientists produce as many myths of creation as the non-scientists have done throughout the ages. But they're all myths. When it comes to the totality, we are all in the realm of myth and fable. So whether your cosmology comes from Hoyle or from Dirac or it comes from Milne or anybody else, they're all myths. But something transcendent is trying to emerge through this. Now the law of the body, and remember it's derived from our primordial animal ancestor, the law of the body is the survival of the individual, is it not? It was the law of the jungle. So aggressiveness, fear, seeing to it that I'm all right, is ingrained in all the 15 or how many million cells that constitute the body. All this is here. And this marvelous mechanism of the bodily process has been built up, in which perhaps the two main factors at play, naturally, are pleasure-pain. If I lost my sense of pleasure-pain with the reception of all sorts of stimuli and impulses, the body would perish in double quick time. It would not survive. It would not know how to move about in the world, and so forth. When I do that at a rose bush, instead of just holding the rose gingerly, I would grasp a whole lot of thorns, and so forth. So this pleasure-pain mechanism is ingrained here. But the body, with its own natural bodily wisdom, takes the pleasure-pain mechanism in its stride and utilizes it as a tool. Now there's a psychological counterpart to our pleasure-pain mechanism, the bodily pleasure-pain mechanism. This sensation is pleasant. I like it. Now this is the psyche talking. The body doesn't say I like it or dislike it. The body merely knows whether it should withdraw or not withdraw, and so on. You see? I like this. I want more of it. I don't like that. Oh, I'll push it away or fight against it or, if necessary, destroy it. See? Craving and violence emerge. Craving and violence. And these two factors are involved in the preservation of the bodily life. But this uprising of craving produces this thirst for sentient existence. That sort of sentient existence which gives pleasure all the time. There, if you like, is perhaps the origin of this, which lies at the root of our difficulty. Our ill-ease, our unease. Now, what is uneasy? Is it the body? The body can be uneasy, of course. But is it not primarily a question of our psychical state? No mind, supposing there were no mind, I would not register anything at all. I would just react automatically, like a stone reacts, or something like that. Reacts to, say, temperature, pressure, or whatever it is. If I am a stone and suddenly a volcano erupts, I'll merely become great big red hot mass, or just become so much molten stone flowing down as lava. There's no me to matter, to whom anything would matter at all. Isn't that so? It is in the psyche, it's the mind, where this situation arises of being uneasy, anxious, afraid, happy, feeling secure, feeling insecure, all the opposites, everything is there, love, hate, and all the rest of it. At the psychophysical level, which is the level of duality. But there's something else too. This very psychophysical organism, time and again, has its little flashes of transcendence. Whether I lived a million years ago on this planet, or whether I'm alive today, aren't there moments when suddenly, perhaps, I draw the curtains and look through the window or open the window, or open the door and step out. Wonderful sunshine. Look at all this. Look at it. Look at the beauty of it, the marvel of it. Now, supposing it was blowing hard and cold and miserable and all the rest of it. But look at it. This is what it is. Now, if I could live in it, that is the state of ease, not of unease. But I have my preferential choice, which is the curse. I prefer this against that. But the totality is a totality. Within the totality, everything is held. You can't deport anyone or anything out of totality to nowhere. It's not possible. Now, the mind, is this something which is impressible in a manner which the animal or the tree or the stone is not? And the law of the mind is the reverse, but not an irreconcilable opposite, but a true complement to the law of the body. The law of the body, the animal body, is concerned with self-preservation. The law of the mind is concerned with the realization of the totality. Well, let's have no illusions about this realization of totality. I know how easily some people use the term cosmic consciousness, as if you could sort of be conscious of everything in the universe. Your head will burst if you get anywhere near that absurd state. And a very unpleasant state it is, and a state of real dukkha to try to get at that. No. But you become aware. You become aware of relationships, of the wholeness. The sense of wholeness absolutely permeates your whole being. And in that sense, with that sense of wholeness permeating your being, all the particulars find their proper place. They are in right relationship. In your awareness, to your vision. Therefore, if things are not in their proper place, and you yourself can't do anything about it, you do not fret about it unnecessarily. You're not indifferent to it. You're sensitive to it. But you know that you can't do anything. Therefore, there is no conceit involved in it. And there is, in actual fact, deep compassion. The so-called failures and sorrows are the seeds of Mahakaruna. If there is no selfness involved in dealing with the failures and the sorrows. This is the point. This is a matter of the mind. Now, this law of the mind at first seems the opposite of the law of the body, that they are enemies. They are not. The one grows out of the other. You know, it's a curious thing. When science started looking into matter, science approaches reality through the study of matter. It propounded its theories and so forth, and you know how we got our atomic theories, and we got 92 elements, and then in this century a few man-made elements in the laboratory and so forth. And long before we made the elements, towards the end of last century and the beginning of this one, we began to feel, at last we've got to the fundamental thing, which is the one basic stuff out of which the whole universe comes, the atom. In India and in China, around about the 6th and the 5th centuries BC, they had ideas along similar lines. And they produced some quite interesting intellectual speculations corresponding to our modern theories of valency and combination and so forth. chemical combination. And then we came to the atom and we got inside the atom. It's possible, you know, although the atom is so tiny that 10 to the power 28 atoms make up one human body, you can get inside the atom, but you can. We got inside the atom and we found that there wasn't a one thing. There were at least three things. There was a gentleman called the proton, and there was a lady called the electron, who was the doer all the time. You know, she was frightfully active. I mean, she was the busybody. The man, being a mere male, just looked on. He had this extraordinary magical power. His mere presence kept the lady active, you see. However, and then there was a strange fellow called the neutron, who was neither male nor female. Till one day in this century, they finally discovered, good gracious me, this neutron is not so non-male or non-female, he's both combined. You see, you can get I say, correct me if I'm wrong, if you once get the electron out of the neutron, there's the proton and all. So instead of finding a one thing ultimately, we found lots and lots of little things in this microscopic world, this world of the atom. A world of marvel and magic and mystery, even greater perhaps in some ways than our physical world as it is. Now, how are we to look at this? Supposing we take the world of the senses, the bodily senses and the ordinary discursive mind with its incessant chatter. If we take it as a cone, we'll say, and call that physical, and then invert another cone and make the pointed ends meet. And don't keep them too pointed, you know, it's rather difficult balancing. Let them sort of intermingle a little bit here, and so you'll get another cone going upwards there. That's the world of the mind. An immensity, another immensity. All pictures, all similes, of course, have their drawbacks, their failures. But use it up to the point that it may be, that may help you, and the rest of it you can throw away. Here are these two cones like this. Now you know, this cone of the mind is completely dependent, where you and I are concerned, with the cone of the body. So the law which concerns the body is intimately intermingled, is in intimate interaction with the law of the mind. The one stimulates the other. The law of the mind is one which sort of calls, evokes, it has an evocative power, the law of the body. And the body has a stimulative power on the mind. Because the mind, as we all know, we get worried, we get hurt, we get depressed, we get unhappy, and we suffer, and so forth. And all these are the stimuli which the body throws up into the mind, and to the mind. Now, become aware of the whole. It is one great whole. See? Something marvelous is emerging through it all. Don't ask me what. Perhaps I can tell you, but I won't. It can be put into words. Those words will be partly useful. But then they are my words. They are no use to you. You find out for yourself. Something marvelous, something mysterious is coming out. All I need say is, let it come out. Don't prevent it. Because in the letting it come out, life functions unhindered, unobstructed through you. And in that is the purification process, the enlightening process. The whole of a religious life perhaps could be, if we want to talk in terms of classification, classified as purification and meditation. Meditation means the process of realization by the mind, is it not? Making real by the mind. But you make real not what you have predetermined or preconceived, because that is the obstruction. If you everlastingly prevent this thing from coming to fruition, the trunk of a tree never, or the branches of the tree don't dictate to the bud just exactly how it will flower. It happens. They merely do their part of the work. They fulfill themselves, their duties, and lo and behold, the beauty of the eternal is in that flower, and in that flower. And it is like that with us too. We are the flowers, if you like, of the tree of human life. Everyone can be like the flower. And the marvel and the mystery is this. Each one of us is not only the flower. Each one of us is also the whole tree. This is the extraordinary thing. Now this only lends point to what I said. Becoming aware of the totality. Because the totality is embodied in the particulars which make up that totality. This infinite variety which is there, which is the marvel and the beauty of the universe. Each one of these infinite particulars embodies the totality. Philosophers have spilled a lot of ink unnecessarily, producing tomes and tomes about the problem of the one and the many. There's no problem about it. The one is the many which constitute the one. Here is one body. There aren't two bodies. Does any one of you see two bodies here? No, you all see one body. All right. There is one body here, but it is made up. What, are so many organs, so many bones, so many blood corpuscles and all the rest of it, isn't it? So what is the problem about the one and the many? That is how it is. The one is the many which constitute the one. But what is the significance of it? The many are in interrelationship, complete and perfect interrelationship, between each other, with each other, and with the one, and within the one. Now this is a matter of being aware. It's a mode of awareness, consciousness. This mode of awareness, because there again it's a bad phrase, mode of awareness, suggesting that there are so many modes, but I'm sorry, I can't help that. This mode of awareness is a peace-giving mode. It releases peace. It is the awareness in which there is wisdom. If you like to use the word consciousness in the sense of vijnana, which is a discriminative consciousness, as far as I can see, separates this, that and the other. It's more analytical than anything. It's analytical and then it synthesizes again. Puts the bits together. This vijnana becomes vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavati.